All right, new episode of Young and Naive. I have a new guest. Who are you?
I am Irene Khan. I am the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Opinion and Expression. And I know you will now say, what is a Special Rapporteur? It's an independent expert. There are about 40 plus of us at any given time, appointed by the member states, by the governments of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. We are not employees. We don't get a salary. We work because we love human rights and want to promote it.
You do it for free?
We do it for free. And it also makes us independent of any influence.
All right. What do you do in Berlin? What do you do in Germany? What brings you here?
I'm here on an official visit. Among the many things I do, I receive complaints from individuals, I produce reports for the UN, I report to the UN General Assembly and the Human Rights Council, but there is something else I do, and that is travel to some countries to really dig deep to find out what's happening there on freedom of opinion and expression, and that's why I'm here in Germany.
So you've dug deep in Germany?
Well, as much as you can dig in about 2 weeks, but of course I've come prepared, and I'll probably stay with it for a little while, too. Yeah.
And it's the first time ever that a UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression has visited Germany.
That's right.
Because you have never been invited by Germany, or nobody ever cared about?
Well, no. Germany, like all European Union member states, have an open invitation to Special Rapporteurs. But I'm the first one with this mandate to visit Germany. There have been other mandates that have visited the country, but not freedom of opinion and expression. I think that's important. Maybe the issue has become important for Germany and also, I think, for the world.
Why?
Because in the digital age, communication means something quite different from what it was in other times. Mm-hmm. It's democratized. Like this podcast, for example, the kind of people you will reach through this, you would not have been able to do that through traditional means a few decades ago. Mm-hmm. And I would not have been able to put out my views out there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very powerful thing. It's a very energizing thing. But it's also a very dangerous thing in some cases. So it can be dangerous. If I use my power of speech to hurt others, to damage institutions, to undermine human rights, then it can be dangerous. But it also empowers me as an individual, as an activist, to promote ideas, to build support, to reach out and make people think about issues they haven't thought about before.
Before we talk about all of what you do, what you've researched and all this, I guess you've never been the Special Rapporteur all your life.
No.
Only since 2020.
That's right, yes.
What have you done before?
Well, I have an interesting...
Where are you from?
I'm from Bangladesh. I was born in Bangladesh. I left Bangladesh at the age of 16, went to school in Northern Ireland. Yes, you might say, why Northern Ireland? But that's the way it happened.
No, why did you leave Bangladesh?
Because of the war.
Because of the genocide?
Because of the war in the early 70s. And I left that time to go to school. My parents didn't know anything better. Communications, you see, there was no internet to search. So I ended up in Northern Ireland. And then from there, I went to law school in UK first, and then in US at Harvard Law School. And then I got found a fellowship to study human rights. I went to Geneva, ended up with the UN for about 20 years. And then I got a bit tired of the UN. I thought I had to do something different. And I then
Now you're back.
And now I'm back. But then I joined Amnesty International. I was head of Amnesty International for 8 years, which was an exciting, very fulfilling job. And then I did another position like that on rule of law, which is my background. I'm a lawyer. And then back here I am in the UN now, actually paying back, I think, in a way, for the great career and the interesting times that I've had.
Why did you become a lawyer?
I became a lawyer because I think the rule of law is so fundamental to protection of human rights. And I say rule of law, not rule by law. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between the two concepts.
Why?
Rule of law means certain principles of equality, due process, fairness, justice, rule by law. Well, every country in the world has laws, mm-hmm. but some of those laws are tyrannical.
Mm-hmm. And we favor the rule of law, of course.
I think in Western democracies, that's what you believe you have. Most of the time, it works that way because you have rights, you have systems that uphold the rights, and systems that allow citizens to hold those in power mm-hmm. to account. So that is a kind of system of rule of law in which human rights are properly protected.
How did you get into the whole human rights thing?
I got in the human rights thing because, you know, when I went to law school in Harvard, it was 1979.
Oh, you got into Harvard?
Into Harvard. And they didn't actually have a course on human rights.
What?
No, they didn't. And I was fascinated by the subject. My thesis, my master's thesis, was actually on Palestine, on Palestinian self-determination.
Wow.
And its recognition under international law. This was way back in 1979. Mm. So I started studying human rights. I got a fellowship from Ford Foundation to go and work in a human rights organization in Geneva. And then from there, I got into the UN Human Office for Refugees, spent about 20 years with them in different parts of the world, Amnesty, and so on. I've been deeper and deeper into human rights as to how to protect human rights, how to make it real for people on the ground, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's a legal subject. And I was actually in some ways tired of studying the law and the framework and so on. I also wanted to see what people do with their rights. And that's how I got into Amnesty and activism and other things.
Are you still interested in Palestine and all this?
Oh, I am, very much so.
Why?
I've been there for a long time. Well, because, you know, it's there are very few races, mm-hmm. Nations in the world that struggle so much for freedom, and it eludes them. Mm-hmm. And Palestine goes back to the 1940s, and the Palestinian people have been used by so many governments in so many ways, while the people themselves have struggled for freedom, for self-determination, and are still doing so, and have become a symbol of what's wrong, I think, with the human rights system.
Hmm. I read that you took a look into, you know, Palestinian repression of Palestinian protests in Germany. We can talk about that.
Mm. Well, actually, what I did was about 2 years. You know, I have a global mandate, uh-huh. which means that I'm not supposed to focus on too deeply on a particular country, but I look at global trends, themes, issues like that. When the Gaza crisis started, I began to realize that what was happening in Gaza was not actually stuck in Gaza. It was actually spreading around the world and having a huge impact on people's freedom of expression, people's right to protest, people's right to criticize, to mobilize, to organize in countries in almost every region, in every region of the world.
Really?
Many, many countries, yes, protest. Countries where people, if you showed them a map and told them where is Palestine, they would not be able to put their finger on it, and yet they were out in the streets protesting the injustice that they saw.
Hier ist Hans, der informelle Alterspräsident hier. Aus Erfahrung geboren der Hinweis, es lohnt sich, Jung und Naiv zu unterstützen, per Überweisung oder PayPal. Guckt in die Beschreibung. Das ist gleich ein ganz anderer Hörgenuss, ehrlich.
But how did it spread with the start of the war? How did it get out of Gaza into the world? What do you mean?
I think it was media, of course, uh-huh. and interestingly enough, a lot of social media, because it was citizen journalists in Gaza. Uh-huh. If you remember the young girl uh-huh. and how she used her iPhone, individuals all over were sending images, sending stories. Uh-huh. So it was a very human story of how human beings, what happens to them on a daily basis when you have that level of violence on the streets.
Like, especially within the last 2 years, a lot of young people got their news about the war in Gaza through TikTok, for example. Yeah. I mean, I know this is not a topic for Germany, but like the American version of TikTok has been sold mm-hmm. now to like a consortium of Larry Ellison, who's very famous for being very pro-Israel or very close to the Netanyahu government. And they basically admitted, yeah, we're going to repress Gaza and Palestine topics. Does that worry you?
It worries me a lot. Because I said earlier that social media and digital technology have actually democratized communications,
yes.
empowered people, or at least that's what we believed for a while. But then the big oligarchs take over, the big tech comes into it, it becomes big business, and then information begins to get manipulated. Mm-hmm. Information, access to information, the right to freedom of expression are not commodities for sale. Yes, they operate in a commercial world, and you have to be financially viable, of course, but these are actually public goods. Information is a public good. It's like water. Now, there is a glass of water in front of me. Mm-hmm. You would not expect the utility that provides water. You would not be allowed by the state, by the government. The utility would not be allowed by the government to put sugar in the water so that I drink too much of it, mm-hmm. or poison in the water that kills me. Mm-hmm. And yet, when we look at the social media environment, isn't that what's happening? Companies, in order to get people to consume more, can drive certain types of news up or suppress certain types of news by these platforms, change the way in which they operate. We've seen that with Twitter mm-hmm. turning into X, for example. So that's what happens to something that is absolutely fundamental to democracy, to human rights, to human dignity.
So it's a problem that freedom of expression, freedom of opinion is being treated as a business now.
It is being treated as a business, and not just a business, a tradable commodity.
Yes.
Because the U.S., for example, talks about putting tariffs, raising tariffs, if Europe should seek to regulate mm-hmm. American big tech companies. So that's like other commodities, mm-hmm. automobiles or whatever.
So should like the topic of social media platforms is the answer to like... make it publicly owned? What was the... I mean, nobody wants to get rid of social media because it's such a great tool for Absolutely. Democratic discourse and freedom of expression.
Absolutely.
But like the way it's being owned needs to change?
Ownership is a big issue. And also with traditional media, ownership is a big issue. Until very recently, the European Union did not even require member states to be transparent about media ownership. So mm-hmm. we thought we were getting diverse media, but all the outlets were open. Owned by the same owner, and therefore you got a certain lack of diversity.
And, I mean, most old private media here in Germany is owned by oligarchs and billionaires, Bertelsmann,
exactly.
Springer.
But their their reach is limited.
Yes.
And also the editorial, there's a degree of editorial control. Mm-hmm. So you know what you're reading. If you're reading the New York Post or you're reading the New York Times, you know the editorial line. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to social media, it's actually all of us, what we put on there. And it's the companies that decide how to amplify, how much to amplify, and what goes up and what goes down, and how there can be, at the end of the day, a profit for them out of that business.
And they would say this is the freedom of the market or freedom of capitalism. How dare you infringe our freedom?
Yes, and that is it. That there is also a kind of a relationship between the big tech, US-based big tech, and the concept of First Amendment, which is also about freedom to speak whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Whereas under international law, freedom of expression is not an absolute right. Freedom of opinion, which is about thoughts in your mind, that is absolute. No one should be able to meddle around with your mind. Mm-hmm. But what comes out of your mouth, what you express through the way you behave, whether it's clothing or symbols or songs or music or art, there are some limits to it.
So that's the key difference between freedom of opinion, mm-hmm. thinking whatever mm-hmm. you want, mm-hmm. and freedom of speech.
Yes.
publicly saying.
Yeah, publicly saying it. And you can say it in words or pictures or symbols or images or whatever, and that is all covered. You can say it across borders. You can access information. You can share information. It is a very wide, broad right recognized under international law, but it has restrictions. The biggest restriction is when your freedom begins to affect the freedom of others.
Right.
So, for example, I am not allowed to use my right of speech to destroy your reputation. Mm-hmm. That is defamation. Mm-hmm. It exists as a crime or as a legal action in all legal systems. Mm-hmm. There are also other grounds like national security, public order, public health. Mm-hmm. We saw during COVID, reasons of public health, governments could make certain restrictions on where you go, what you say. So there are certain limits to freedom of expression, but those limits under international law are defined very narrowly. The first thing is it has to be lawful, which means it has to be clear. People need to know what the restriction is and not leave it to the discretion of the authorities to decide what and when the limit your speech. Mm-hmm. It also has to be necessary. The restriction has to be necessary and proportionate in order to protect these interests that I was talking about, other people's rights and reputation, national security, public order, public health, public morals. These are sort of recognized objectives. So it has to be necessary and proportionate for that. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that you censor entirely in order to ensure national security.
Like the right-wing parties here, quasi-fascist, like they always be like, oh, the freedom of speech is restricted in Germany. And they always make the point of, you know, denial of the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
which is illegal. Also like using, you know, Nazi symbols and all this. Mm-hmm. If I understand you correctly, this is okay with international law.
It may, yes, but it is limited.
Yes.
You know, you cannot use the excuse of banning Nazi symbols to ban all kinds of symbols, for example. Mm-hmm. And if you are banning Nazi symbol, then as a state, you're expected to show that it's a necessary and proportionate thing in order to protect, say, national security. Mm-hmm. So there is a link between what your restriction is and what the objective is. And the objective has to be a legitimate objective that's set out in international law. And your restriction has to be necessary and proportionate and the least intrusive of freedom of expression. So if you have choices, then you should choose as a state the least intrusive one. So the argument is in favor of free speech, but it's not unlimited free speech, and especially not unlimited in terms of the damage or harm that you can do to others. Under international law, promoting a lie is not unlawful, except if it is a piece of lie that actually leads to, say, incitement of violence. Mm. So if I spread rumors about an ethnic group that I know will then rouse strong emotions and can lead to a massacre, then that is incitement to hatred that leads to violence, and that must be prohibited. State does not have a choice when there is such a huge kind of danger or risk. Otherwise, the state can restrict certain things in the interest of national security.
Mm-hmm.
They may not, they may. There is some leeway there, but it has to be clear, it has to be narrow, it has to be linked, necessary and proportionate and linked to the objective.
Going back to the social media platforms, most of them, the big ones are American.
Yes.
Is the problem, because we're talking about international standards and law, that these companies, they view it as a American First Amendment problem or not problem? And the American First Amendment is very broad compared to
That is right. The First Amendment is basically the state shall not interfere with a private entity or person's freedom of expression.
Like basically, hate speech is legal in America. Like, there are rare exceptions, like if you, you know, incite violence, concrete violence.
Well, in law school, we were taught that you cannot go into a crowded theater and shout fire.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, you're obviously doing something that's going to create a lot of disruption and could hurt people trying to get out of the theater and, you know, even lead to injury and so on. So there are some restrictions like that that have come over time because of court decisions and real problems.
Yes.
But generally speaking, under American U.S. law, freedom of expression, First Amendment is a very broad right. Mm-hmm. And so there is a tendency to look at this open space of social media as a free-for-all. But we have seen that while social media is a great boon to empower people with freedom of expression, it is also a risk in certain situations.
Irene, hate, inspiring hatred is good for business. Let's be honest. It drives the algorithm. Yeah. It drives engagement.
Yes, of course.
Clicks.
Apparently, human nature, unfortunately, seems to be such that we are more attracted to hate and sensational news and things like that. And so we stay online longer, and therefore the companies make more money out of us by selling us things and collecting data.
That's why the companies love the seemingly total freedom.
Yeah, they love that. But I think over time they have learned, because the state governments have realized that they need to restrict freedom of expression, not always because they want to ensure proper right to freedom of expression. They have their own agenda, political agenda. Mm-hmm. And so you see actually governments and companies sometimes coming closer together to control certain types of speech, but not other types of speech.
Mm. Going back to your example of expression lies, expression of lies can be illegal unless it's incitement.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately had to think of January 6th, 2020, mm-hmm. of Donald Trump basically spreading lies in Washington, mm-hmm. like very close to the Capitol, talking to his people, his protesters, basically telling them the election was stolen, mm-hmm. and the members of my parliament will now officially say that Joe Biden has won the election. And he basically incited these people to go and march to the Capitol and use violence. Is that...
Well, that's a very dangerous lie. You know, there can be an innocent lie. If I were to tell your viewers now that I'm a blonde woman,
uh-huh.
well, okay, it doesn't hurt anyone except my own image. That's it. But if I go out and I'm the president of the United States or a candidate for the presidential elections, and I say... the election has been fraudulent, it has been stolen, and you need to go claim your rights back, then that is something very different. So speech, whether you restrict speech or not, also depends very much on the context. Who says it? To whom is it being said? With what intent? What impact? Am I saying it in my bedroom, or am I saying it in front of 5,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
Makes a lot of difference to what I say and who I am. If I'm just an ordinary citizen, that's one thing. If I am the president of a big, powerful country or a political leader or a religious leader or someone that people believe, then there is a certain responsibility to what I say. No, and that's why even restricting hate speech or what you believe is hate speech has to be done very carefully, because you have to look at the context. Not everything I say should be labeled as hate speech and restricted, because it suits someone else. That's not the idea. The idea is to really look at the degree of her harm and the need to restrict the speech rather than to allow it to spread, because it is an important right. It's a democratic right. Mm-hmm. Democracies can't survive without freedom of expression.
Should speech by powerful people be more or less restricted than speech of less powerful or not ordinary citizen?
Well, you are putting a very interesting question, because I have been grappling in the last few days with a particular provision of the criminal code in Germany,
yes,
section 188, under which, for the first time, I've come across this offense of offending, this crime of offending a person in power, a public official, mm-hmm. In a way that he's unable to do his job, that is actually a crime. Mm-hmm. Usually it's the other way around. Citizens actually tend to criticize or have the right to criticize their leaders in quite harsh terms, if necessary.
Mm-hmm. It says, for our international audience, section 188 of the German Criminal Code provides enhanced criminal protections against insults, defamation, and slander directed at persons in political life, especially when the actor is capable of undermining their public role. As I understood it, this was for like local politicians, mm-hmm. people who are engaging in democracy and want to, you know, help conserve democratic institutions and all this. But mostly, when it comes to the public in the last couple of years, this was used for the very powerful. Mm-hmm. In Germany,
absolutely,
like ministers, leading politicians, and they made use, or certain agencies. We can talk about those, like trusted flaggers, mm-hmm. like here it's like Hate Aid, yeah, and all this. Yeah. They in the name of these powerful people, they try to use this section. Mm. What do you think of this?
Well, I think it's an abuse of power. As you said, a politician, whether he's a small mayor of a small town or whether he's the president of a big country or she's a foreign minister of a country, you know, these are all powerful positions, right? And citizens are at a disadvantage in front of the power. They have to hold politicians to account. They are sometimes not heard. Sometimes it's very frustrating. They criticize, and maybe they don't use the diplomatic language. There is also, of course, your political satirists, political satire. These are ways in which you get your communication out very powerfully. Yes, sometimes it's funny, you laugh at it. Sometimes it can be cruel in a way as well. But if you are going to go out into public life and stand in front of people and want people to communicate with you, then I think you need to have a thick skin. You need to be ready to be criticized, because accountability is a large part of accountability is strong criticism. But you are a powerful person. You have all the means of the state behind you to promote your message. But you're using the power of the state to shut down someone who's seeking to criticize you.
But like.
So this is why in democratic states, usually the politician is expected to go out there and to expose himself or herself and have people criticize them. Now, of course, with social media coming and making it so much easier for people to smear other people's reputation, it's true that a lot of politicians are coming under hate speech attacks, sometimes violent attacks. So there is need to protect them, obviously, because otherwise you won't get anyone wanting to be a politician. But there has to be a balance between protecting a politician to do their job properly and intimidating mm-hmm. a citizen or a journalist or an artist or a comedian from ridiculing the politician.
So just to make sure that you're not misunderstood, you're not saying defamation of anyone should be illegal?
No.
Because there's the section 185
Absolutely.
In Germany,
yes.
which already
yes.
handles
yes.
defamation
yes.
of
Absolutely.
Regular, of everyone.
Everyone.
But, and
in
188
fact,
is primarily of people in public
fact,
life.
In fact, in many countries of the world, in every country of the world, there is a defamation law. In many countries, it's a civil suit.
Yes.
You say something to me, I feel hurt by it, I take you to court.
Yes.
We are both equal in
yes.
court, theoretically at
yes.
least. And then in some cases, there is criminal defamation where the state steps in because the damage is so much. Criminal defamation already has a much more damping effect on free speech than civil defamation. So it's already a powerful thing that I can actually use the power of the state to go after you if you hurt me or if you threaten me. And here you're a politician, which means that you have a certain degree of power. You're an official, public official, and you are being empowered even more to go after those who criticize you. First of all, there is this perception of imbalance of power between the citizen on the one hand and a state official on the other. And then, of course, that also kind of damages the trust that a citizen has, that here is my representative. I don't like what he's doing. I want to go out and criticize him and, you know, slam him in the media, but I'm not allowed to do that because they feel hurt. They don't want to be mocked. They don't want to be seen to be ridiculous. And you know, you have to protect their honor.
Like, I would think, like, especially female politicians, powerful politicians, they would tell you, like, but what we're experiencing is not criticism. It's like misogynistic shit.
Yes.
It's hatred.
Yes.
It's like they feel that the basically there's an incitement of violence indirectly, mm-hmm. like implicitly or explicitly. Yeah. What do you tell them?
Well, of course, when it comes to that stage where the attack on me is not criticism, it's a threat. You know, rape threats, for example.
Yes.
A lot of female politicians, not just politicians, leaders, a lot of women, journalists, for example, face that kind of threat. Yes. And they need to be protected from it. Okay. That is a different thing from mocking the way you dress or what you look like when you talk or what you have said. You know, if someone says, look, that person is a dumb person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's, you know, there is something called lawful, but not awful, but not lawful, but lawful, you know, it's awful, but it's lawful. So there's a lot of offensive speech that we have to live with in a democratic state because we don't want to become so politically correct that no one is willing to say anything at all, anything meaningful. So there has to be a degree of tolerance in democratic states. And you have your right of reply as well. But when it comes to particularly to political expression, then a politician actually, under international law, political expression is very highly protected. So if you are a political opponent, you can say a lot of things during elections against the other side, for example. So political speech is highly protected. And in that kind of a situation, you're providing extra protection to the political person against the citizen. There seems to me there's a perception problem there. And really, how is it being viewed? Is it actually making democracy work better? That's a question to ask. And I don't know the German situation, but maybe you as a journalist will be exploring these things to see who has used these tools most, not little mayors in some little town in Bavaria or Saxony.
Actually, leading politicians,
yes.
Not from the far right,
yeah.
but also
yeah.
like the far right mm-hmm. Is attacking
yes.
very prominently this 188, yes. but they also use this
yes.
for their own.
Of course, of course.
Which is
if you have tools, if you have tools out there, then they will be manipulated. So that one also has to be careful about how many tools you create in this area, which is a very sensitive and difficult area. What is insult? What is not insult?
Mm-hmm.
You can identify incitement to violence. You can identify hatred. Insult, offense, these are also difficult, vague concepts in law.
And
like
also
extremism. Many things are undefined.
And also, like, when you're a member of a parliament mm-hmm. in Germany, you actually shielded, like you have extra status in the German
yes.
society because you're shielded from criminal prosecution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because you're being protected from wrongful prosecution by the by the government in power, party in power, for example, if
yeah.
you're an opposition
yes.
parliamentarian. So as a parliamentarian, you enjoy some immunity. As a government official, you enjoy some immunity as well for doing what you're supposed to do. So there is a lot of power there. So again, you know, I think one has to look a little bit more carefully as to how this law has been used. Has it actually addressed the issue of misogynistic attacks against female candidates, or has it actually been used to either manipulate the system or to silence and intimidate and silence people?
So this is especially funny in Germany because, like, we actually abolished another section of the German criminal code when it came to insulting a king
mm-hmm.
or a majesty
yes.
or like a state leader. There was a
less majesty
famous case like 10 years ago So this was seems to me very similar.
Yes. So in many countries of the world, they have these lèse majesté laws where you cannot insult the king. In Thailand, for example, a lot of people have been sent to prison, not for insulting the king, but for saying things like, you know, maybe we should have a republic, or maybe the king has behaved in a certain way that is not good for the country. Whatever, even questioning anything the king does could lead you into a prison sentence.
So, and you call for the abolishment of this section, not because this is your private opinion, but I read like the Human Rights Committee in 2011 made remarks when it came to freedom of opinion and expression, and it says states parties, like every state in the world, states parties should consider the decriminalization, yes, of defamation, mm-hmm, and especially not and it's that imprisonment, mm-hmm, of, you know, people who, mm-hmm, defame other people is never an appropriate penalty.
Yes. So it's not my personal opinion. It's actually this committee is the body that is authorized to monitor and advise on the international treaty where, mm-hmm, this right, mm-hmm, is located. So that is why decriminalization of speech is extremely important. And criminalization of speech is also a very severe act, and you do not do it very easily in democratic states, because it's a very powerful tool that the state, the police, the justice system then holds over your head, and it can be misused.
Well, do you have an opinion on the role of so-called trusted flaggers of, you know, mostly NGOs or something, who in the name of most of the time powerful people, you know, go to the police and...
Well, I think the trusted flaggers, their role might actually be more exaggerated than they actually have, the power they have. Mm-hmm. What they are doing is they have been pre-cleared as a reliable organization that knows what it's talking about, like fact checkers,
yes,
right? And they are then flagging it, so it's basically kicking it up to someone's desk saying, this is something you should look at. Mm-hmm. But in the social media context, it's really up to the company, the social media platform, to decide whether or not they will remove the post or take any other measures to restrict its amplification and so on. So what these people are doing is they're just a kind of a system for speeding up that review. They don't have a lot of power to determine whether or not a post should be up or taken down.
And especially when it comes to like repression of, you know, pro-Palestinian protests, I have the feeling, I don't have like any statistics, but like the role of trusted flaggers when it comes to so-called anti-Semitism is also sometimes abused. Like, oh, look at these Palestinians calling for free Palestine, and this is anti-Semitic and all this.
Well,
and then the police are like, oh, yeah, let's get rid of this.
I actually, in my report that you we talked about earlier about the impact of Gaza on freedom of expression around the world, there is a significant part about what happened online. And we've seen online bias identified by the oversight board of Meta itself, you know, the company that owns Facebook and, mm-hmm, Instagram, their own oversight board that they have appointed to oversee and comment on their performance. That board has not once, but I think twice, found that Meta is actually biased against pro-Palestinian speech as opposed to pro-Israeli speech, from the way in which they have handled various posts and the number of takedowns they do, and the same thing in Hebrew they will allow but not allow it in Arabic from a Palestinian source. So that is actually well proven.
But is it like a lawful bias? Because it's like,
no,
it's a corporation, we can do whatever we want.
No, it's not a lawful bias at all.
It's an awful
Meta
bias.
Has its own awful bias, yes. Meta has its own sort of systems and its own rules. Meta has its own rules, and there's one about designated organizations, rather like your counterterrorism system. You know, they have a listed organizations, and if they think it's belong, you're talking about that those kinds of organizations, they might remove you more you know, because they feel that that's wrong. Sometimes, of course, Meta would say in their own defense that they have to follow the national law of the land. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., certain organizations are banned, say Hamas. So if you are promoting some information on Hamas, Meta is obliged to remove it mm-hmm. because Meta is operating in the U.S., and in the U.S., it's unlawful to do that. Mm-hmm. So there are some national laws that they also follow. So I'm trying to be fair to them. But over and beyond that, we've also seen that journalists, for example, reporting, and during the Gaza crisis, journalists reporting on what's happening in Gaza on certain situations don't get the kind of publicity or amplification that you would expect. Mm-hmm. So there has been a certain bias proven there. Sometimes I think in one case Meta actually admitted that it was an issue of language. What happens is they're not investing as much in Arabic language as they are, say, in English or in Hebrew. So the human loop is not there, and sometimes the context is therefore forgotten because algorithms don't necessarily do as good a job. So the lack of investment in certain situations and not in others. If you compare Ukraine with Palestine, it's a very interesting comparison there, where you saw how accurately and more effectively companies responded to issues of social media manipulation in the context of Ukraine as compared to the context in Gaza.
Hi, Tyler hier, Producer von Jung und Naiv. Ohne euch gibt's uns nicht. Jeder Euro zählt und ab 20 landet ihr als Produzenten im Abspann auf YouTube. Weiter geht's.
I mean, your job also entails freedom of media, I guess.
Yes,
I mean, since we talked about Gaza itself, what's your opinion on the record number of killings
It's of journalists? It's absolutely appalling. More journalists have been killed in the conflict in Gaza than in any other conflict since records have been kept. And many of these journalists are local journalists. International media has not been allowed free access to Gaza since October 2023.
Still isn't. No?
Still isn't. And when international journalists are not there, local journalists are doubly exposed. And Israel's response in many cases of targeted killings, I'm not talking about a shelling of a building in which a journalist happens to live. I'm talking about targeted killing of journalists who are wearing jackets with press on their back, who are driving in cars marked as press, and who are doing activities that press do, like taking photographs of situations or reporting, etc., who have been targeted. And Israel's answer has been that these people are actually either linked to Hamas or carrying out some terrorist activities mm-hmm. without ever producing any evidence or allowing an independent investigation of these cases. There's never been that.
And if I'm right, it actually doesn't matter if a journalist had some connections in the past to, let's say, Hamas, unless you're a combatant.
Unless you're a combatant.
Like who's fighting with a weapon right now.
Not only that, unless you're actually actively supporting one party to the conflict.
Yes.
You know? And you may have been doing some work years ago, but that does not mean, but you continue to be protected as a civilian.
Yeah.
You know, the line between a civilian and a combatant is very clearly drawn in international law, and a journalist is considered to be a civilian until and unless he's participating in some military activity.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had situations, one in particular, a journalist from Al Jazeera, who actually was targeted last year. He got in touch with me in July because he felt that he was going to be targeted and killed. The methodology seems to be, from cases that have happened, is that first there is a smear campaign against the journalist, which means sort of discrediting his reporting, spreading stories that he may have connections with some terrorist groups and he's really not a journalist doing reporting. All that happens and keeps growing and growing. He may receive threats, he may be asked to, you know, flee or whatever, and he doesn't. And then they go in and kill him. Now, this gentleman got in touch with me in July and he wrote to me saying that this was happening to him and he was afraid. He was the only Al Jazeera journalist at that time operating in northern Gaza. So he was very vulnerable. He realized that. And then I put out a press release exposing that story in the hope that that might deter the Israeli Defense Forces. And he said that he was receiving phone calls from a particular person in the IDF, a named person, who was sort of telling him, oh, you know, they are your friends. You know, there would be some killing somewhere. And then they'd say, oh, we killed your friends and so on, implying that he had connection with Hamas. And eventually they did kill him.
Wow.
In a tent with a lot of other people. He was killed. And he left behind a message actually saying, if you're reading this message, that means I have been killed by the Israelis. So it was a very, very clear case of targeted killing. Israel did not deny it. Israel's answer was, well, this person was an agent of Hamas. Mm-hmm. And he was, and there was some story about him being actively engaged in combat. But this guy was in front of the camera, in front of Al Jazeera's camera. So you could see how many hours he was.
He was fighting with his words.
There you are. So that was it.
Spreading truth.
Yeah. So we've had cases like that. And some of these cases have been investigated by investigative journalism groups, by the Washington Post, for example. They looked into a couple of cases. Others have done it. So there are reputable international news agencies that are looking into these cases. None of them have been able to prove this connection that Israel claims these journalists have with Hamas.
And just to be clear, if the other side, like Hamas fighters, are trying to kill or kill Israeli journalists by saying, oh, Irene, they've been into IDF before. They have like an IDF pass or something. They listed part of being like a reserve IDF fighter, as every Israeli is, because they are mandatory to go to the Israeli military. This is also wrong.
This is absolutely wrong, because journalist is a journalist. And a journalist, he or she, is protected under international law as a civilian. In fact, I am now working on a project to promote the idea that a journalist requires more than just your regular protection that a civilian would get, because a journalist is deliberately exposing himself or herself in the reporting exercise. You can't run away from the fighting. You have to go towards the fighting. So you actually face a higher degree of danger than other civilians might. You're more like an ambulance driver, and you're playing an extremely important role of getting information out to the world. And journalists, therefore, need a higher level of protection, and governments and other combatant parties, for the parties that are parties to the conflict, need to ensure protection for higher level of protection for journalists. They need to understand the role of journalists, how important it is.
Do you have a personal opinion on why Israel doesn't want international media in Gaza?
Well, it's not just my personal opinion. I think having looked at it and examined it, I'd professionally say that, killing the journalist often is seen as a strategy for killing the story. And if you have international journalists there, they will, of course, have more credibility than local journalists, and they will dig out some stories. And Israel does not want those stories to be exposed. It's not just that journalists are being killed; journalists' equipment are being destroyed. You know, remote cameras are being destroyed. Why would you do that? Unless you want certain images to be destroyed, certain information to be destroyed.
Especially when you publicly say your warfare is lawful and just, then you shouldn't have a problem with international journalists researching your warfare.
And when you know that there is a whole history of cases piling up, there are complaints being developed, the International Criminal Court is investigating, looking into issues of war crimes, crimes against humanity, the possibility of genocide is also before the International Court of Justice. All those issues are there. And it is not just a war on the ground. It is also a war of public opinion. So you have to win that narrative. You have to change that narrative. And that's why the discrediting of journalists, the smear campaigns, the targeted killings, the threats, put all that story together. And you are moving towards a conclusion that the journalist is being killed in order to kill the story.
Did you get in touch with people who experienced smear campaigns when it comes to Gaza or, you know, reporting on Israel here in Germany. I mean, I personally have been under attack by Israeli officials. You know, they make it like the top 10 list of anti-Semitic journalists in Germany. And
yes, because you see, that is another issue that I have taken up here in Germany, and that is the definition of anti-Semitism. Now, anti-Semitism is hatred towards Jews, which is wrong, which is prohibited under international law, which should be condemned. Mm-hmm. Now, that does not translate into criticism of Israel, which is a state like any other state, a government like any other government, that has to be open to scrutiny, to public scrutiny and criticism. So when I criticize Israel, I'm not criticizing the Jewish people. I don't think the Jewish people worldwide or even in Israel are necessarily responsible
Haven't you read the IHRA definition? Which is very vague and can be used.
Exactly. And I have not only written it, I've written about it, where I have challenged that definition precisely because of those provisions which would imply that criticism of Israel would amount to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I think Israel is a state, like any other state. It should be open to scrutiny and criticized. I would even go so far as to say Zionism is an ideology. And like any other political ideology, it can also be criticized. You believe in it or you don't believe in it, you can criticize it. You can discuss it. It's not sacred. It's nothing to do with the Jewish people.
There are powerful politicians in Germany, like the former minister of culture, Claudia Roth, who say anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism.
I don't think so, because I think the experts will tell you, I'm not an expert in this area, but I have read enough to know that the Zionist theory is a political theory. Mm-hmm. There are many Jews who are not Zionists. There are many Jews who don't believe in Zionism.
Of course.
Yeah.
Did you get in the whole thing of the our German parliament? They made a resolution when it came to the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, the BDS movement.
Yes.
Is it part of your? Has this been
yes,
part of your
that
research?
Is also part of my remit, because there's a whole issue about whether a boycott campaign is political expression, or is it an anti-Semitic attack on Israel? Mm. And there is a court decision by the European Court of Human Rights. It's a case against France, actually, where the court has held that boycotts. Advocacy of a boycott is political expression, and therefore it is protected. It's like any other form of political expression is protected as a right of freedom of expression.
So these resolutions are wrong.
So these resolutions, I think, are being wrongly interpreted. There are some parts of this resolution which talks about hatred against Jews and tropes and so on, which fall into the normal definition that one would understand of anti-Semitism. But there are some references to Israel, which seems extremely strange to be put in a resolution. Anti-Semitism is hatred against a people for their identity characteristics. And to imply that you equate Israel with the Jewish people, no matter where they are, is a very dangerous thing to do, precisely because it leads to more anti-Semitism, not less. Mm. I mean, I have met a lot of young students in this country, Jewish students, who have come to me and said they are being discriminated, they are being attacked, they are being criticized, and they are being held responsible for what is happening in Israel.
Yeah, that's actually like how I grew up. Like I learned, like you cannot go to like a Jewish German and be like, okay, justify what's happening in Israel, because why? This is a German citizen who happens to be Jewish, doesn't have anything to do with Israel, and that's anti-Semitic.
Yeah, so therefore, if you put in that same definition of anti-Semitism, also criticism of Israel, then you are equating Israel with Jews all around the world, and you're endangering Jews. Who have no power, no even democratic means or non-democratic means of influencing the Israeli government.
So this is kind of like the IRA thing is like it's seemingly anti-Semitic itself.
It's counterproductive because what the other thing I have also said in my report, including in my statement that you have in front, I have said that anti-Semitism is rising. It is totally abhorrent and it has to be eradicated.
Yes.
But if you want to eradicate it, then you need to do it according to international human rights standards because you need a universal agreement as to what is anti-Semitism and to bring everyone around it to have an effective response. Mm. If you continue to have these special provisions about Israel, which has nothing to do with actually how the Jewish people are being treated, then you are confusing two things and you are undermining protection of Jews against from anti-Semitism. You are actually introducing, there's a risk of introducing discrimination against another group. And by that, you're actually entrenching hatred and this sort of destabilizing feelings.
One more question regarding the BDS movement. Mm. The people who did the revolution, they called the entire movement anti-Semitic. Mm. Does that matter?
I think it is wrong. Mm-hmm. If you look at the European Court's decision, the European Court of Human Rights decision, what they're saying is that what is BDS about? It's about divestment, boycott and divestment. It is about certain policies, certain political instruments that are being used, advocacy, to influence Israel's policy. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is not anti-Semitic.
Like leading German politicians would tell you, like, for them, this entire BDS movement is what they hear is like, don't buy from Jews, which like reminds them of, you know, the Third Reich. And
well, I think they are misunderstanding the whole situation. There are many, many Jews around the world who produce all sorts of things that BDS is not asking us to boycott from. They are talking about products from Israel. They're looking at a geographic area, a political entity. And to confuse that with a race, that is, some of them are in Israel, many of them are outside Israel, a whole race actually does no service to those who really want to fight anti-Semitism.
And I want to add, there are, of course, supporters of the BDS movement who are anti-Semites.
There might be individuals.
Oh yeah, but you can't mistake the entire.
You cannot label the entire movement. You can't discredit the entire movement. There may be individuals there who have anti-Semitic, or they might be racist. They might even be Islamophobes, for that matter. Mm-hmm. In any movement, you might have that. So you go after the individual, not after the movement. And this movement also has a number of organizations under that umbrella. And, you know, so you can't kind of, you know, it's not the first boycott divestment movement. I'm old enough to remember the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Ukraine. Like, after Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a campaign for boycotting Russian goods, divesting from Russia, and sanctioning Russia.
There was a
BDS movement.
Exactly. So what is so special about Israel? It's a member state of the United Nations. I said that in Parliament, in front of one of your parliamentary committees, because the parliamentarian was telling me that anyone who opposes the existence of Israel has no space room in Germany. And I wanted to make things clear to him. So I said, from my perspective, I'm a UN special rapporteur. Israel is a member state of the UN. And I treat Israel in exactly the same way that I treat any other state of the United Nations, and I don't hesitate to criticize
any double standard.
No double standards. I don't hesitate to
criticize. Because Ira would say, if you use a double standard towards Israel, that's anti-Semitic.
No, so there are no double standards. I criticize all states. I criticize Israel. I expect Israel to uphold international law, to uphold its international human rights commitment in the same way that I would expect any other state to do so.
Especially because Israel calls itself a democracy.
And it has
rule of law. Well, then,
of course, that's his own moral standards it has set, and it has to live up to them.
What is your findings regarding the freedom of assembly in Germany? Like, where you openly express your opinion. I mean, there seems to be a lot of repression when it comes to pro-Palestinian or like protests against the war or the warfare of Israel in Gaza.
Yes, I have. I think I've put it in my statement as being unduly restricted. The right to assembly, and not just the right to assembly, related rights, such as academic freedom and artistic freedom, the right to speak, the deplatforming that is taking place, mm-hmm. Of course, the protests themselves, what you can say in a protest. There is a total ban on a particular slogan because it is seen as being a slogan of Hamas.
The from the river to the sea.
From the river to the sea, exactly. And
which is not from Hamas originally.
First of all, yeah. It is not from Hamas, and there are a lot of learned experts here that will come and tell you the origin of it and what it is, and will challenge this notion that it belongs to Hamas. And secondly, you cannot ban a slogan without looking at the context of it. There's no context to it. Who is saying, where is it being said, do the people even know what river and what sea they're talking about?
Especially when yeah. If the pro-Israeli camp would do a protest, like supporters of Bibi Netanyahu and his party, they have this from the river to the sea in
yes,
their
they
party.
Do. And they do that.
Their party
and,
as well.
And the river to the sea can be read in many ways. It can be read about equality of treatment. Yeah. It can be read about peace and freedom. It can be. There are so many things to read certain things into it. You need to have the context. And that means you cannot simply say that just because you've repeated the sentence, you are therefore a supporter of Hamas. And because Hamas is considered to be a terrorist organization, you are then subject to criminal sanctions. I think it's that kind of jumping from one to the other and creating a security-oriented approach to freedom of expression that is very dangerous for democratic countries.
Is it reasonable to think that this ban on like certain words or sentences like from the river to the sea was actually used to repress, you know, freedom of assembly?
Well, it did. It was a repression of freedom of expression in the context of freedom of assembly, because, mm-hmm. of course, when you're protesting, then what you say is as important as gathering together to say it. Mm-hmm. So there are German courts some of whom have disagreed with that position.
Yeah.
So you have a situation where you have inconsistency and legal uncertainty right now about whether or not it is a banned slogan or not. And there's a case waiting to go to the, to your Federal Court of Justice, mm-hmm. For clarity. And I think everyone, even the authorities that I've spoken to, are looking forward to some clarity because they themselves are not sure. You know, the prosecutor, for example, is not sure whether cases should go or not. Yeah. A number of cases have been dismissed. Some have been dropped. So it's a very, very messy situation. Mm-hmm. And the overall result is that people feel upset and angry and misunderstood over this slogan.
I mean, another high court a few years ago struck down this BDS resolution as well.
Like, yes.
Because it was used for, you know, local assemblies, theater
yes.
groups.
Yes, and there is something quite dangerous that I see in happening in Germany is using these sort of resolutions, parliamentary resolutions, loose concepts, the definition. There's no definition of anti-Semitism. German criminal code. It's not an offense. There is also the use of the term extremism, mm-hmm. That's used. That is also not defined. And yet, using that term, there is the state federal intelligence agency can open surveillance on an organization.
Mm.
Can label that. So there's a stigmatization there. There is self-censorship as a result of it, creates uncertainty, but it's not a legal concept. So when on the one hand, you have this very clear, tough criminalization policy, criminalizing certain things, and on the other hand, you have this rather loose definition of concepts, etc., that are like law, but not really law,
mm-hmm.
and that officials will tell me have no legal consequences. But when I speak to those who have been subjected to it, they tell me how they're being stigmatized, their contracts are not being renewed,
yeah.
people are staying away from them, all sorts of consequences. Funding is being stopped. they're not being allowed access to certain premises, public premises, for example. All sorts of consequences are happening. And yet, it is not legal. And therefore, you cannot even go to court and fight it.
And we talked about the BDS resolution. There was another resolution. The name was like Protection of Jewish Life, but it was actually restricting or seemed to be a repression of academic freedom.
Yes, yes.
Did you into this?
I did speak to a lot of scholars and academics and others who feel, and surveys have been done by the Freie University here, as well as others, about the level of restriction and self-censorship that now exists in academia, where respected professors don't feel that they can comfortably speak with their colleagues about some of these issues. So there is this sort of self-censorship and chilling of expression that is coming in, which is very dangerous, particularly when you are an academic, because academia is supposed to be the one place where we can say what we want, we can discuss all sorts of wild and crazy ideas, because that's from where knowledge comes and innovation comes.
But the other side would be like, that's still the case. It's only about, you know, public funding of academic research. And we need to look into maybe anti-Semitic expressions
but
of you. And we need to screen everything before.
Yeah. But then I've heard that said by some governments, but I would not label them as democratic governments.
That's kind of sad, and especially because it can also apply to Jewish scientists, Jewish academics who fight for, free Israel, free Palestine.
The same thing is happening on to Israeli scholars as is happening to Palestinian or pro-Palestinian scholars, where they are also being deplatformed just because you happen to be an Israeli citizen, and you are an Israeli academic, you are being excluded from certain venues and certain places, etc., being held responsible for things that you've had nothing to do with. So both sides, I think, are suffering. Most of all, I think Germany is suffering because Germany is being deprived of knowledge and debate and discussion that could enrich its own understanding, its own policy making, but people are staying out of it. You know, foreign scholars who are here are scared that their visa might not be renewed, their contract might be jeopardized. They're staying out of it. German scholars are not saying it because they're not sure who else is in the room and how this will be interpreted later.
Yeah, I mean, there are many people who I know who think like this is like this repression of Palestinian protests or like protests against Israeli warfare. This is very like authoritarian, and this is not what Germany as a democratic state who wants to have learned its lesson from the past.
Well, that's the problem with taking the security-oriented approach to freedom of expression, because the original motivation is that you're going to make the environment secure for people, but actually people feel more insecure when there is this uncertainty of what you can say and what you cannot say, who will listen and who will then use it against you.
If you have any questions, give it to Moritz, who will make his debut in a few minutes to ask you some audience questions. What did the German officials, I mean, you've met a lot of officials, I don't know, ministers, but like people in power here. I mean, you probably talked to them about the repression we talked about.
Yes.
What do they tell you? I mean, they will, I guess they will defend.
Well, with the universities, of course, they say, as what you just said now, you know, the universities are autonomous bodies. They receive public funding, but they make their own decisions. So there is a kind of a passing the buck, if I can put it that way. Others say they don't do it. There seems to be some discrepancy about facts, particularly in relation to protests in Berlin. What happened, what didn't happen, how many cases have been charged, whether the police used excessive force or not. You know, the officials have told me that things are getting better. They've got better rules now, less issues with protesters. They have a targeted group that they believe are troublemakers that have a violent background. They're focusing on them. But on the other hand, I hear stories from individuals who come to me who may be working in a firm, a professional woman, and she's going every Saturday to the protest, and she's still being harassed and followed and so on. So there's a gap there in what is actually one side feeling and what on the other hand the other side says is doing. And one of my recommendations to the government, German government, and of course to the state governments eventually, is to establish an independent fact-finding commission with respected experts who have trust and confidence of both sides, to rebuild trust between state and citizen, to figure out what has gone wrong and how do you make it right. Because it is only through that kind of a process that you're going to build some confidence here in between the authorities and the communities.
I'm kind of doubtful that this will happen. As you mentioned, real anti-Semitism is on the rise as well.
Yes.
In Germany.
Yes.
What did Jewish Germans tell you?
Well, I had a very interesting meeting with a group of young students from Humboldt University who basically said that it's only recently that their university has been making it the space safe for Jewish students, that they've realized that there is a problem of anti-Semitism. Changes are being made. There are other universities where similar things have not happened. And they even said that there is a kind of a weaponization of anti-Semitism. And they used a particular German term, which I would not be able to repeat to you, which basically means that there's a cover. You know, you use the term anti-Semitism and we're fighting anti-Semitism, but actually they're not really doing that at all. No. It's just a way of going around that issue.
Yes.
So in reality, things are getting worse. But in rhetoric, there is all this talk about fighting anti-Semitism. So if you are a policymaker, if you are a public official, then you need to ask what is going wrong. And you need to really take an honest view, get independent points of view in there to examine it, because this is something that has to be tackled. We're talking about 2026, and there is still a problem of anti-Semitism in Germany.
And what about Islamophobia? Because, like, especially powerful people in government here, like, they turn this on its head and, like, okay, the real problem is imported anti-Semitism in Germany. Like, I mean, Germany, the perpetrator of the Holocaust, like, German politicians now are like, oh no, the problem is Muslims.
Yes.
They didn't say it like this, but Muslims coming to Germany who bring their cultural hatred of Jews and Israel to Germany, and they are the problem.
Well, I had a very interesting experience with these Jewish students. When I'm talking to pro-Palestinian protesters, activists and others, I get a lot of people from the Middle East, Palestinian community and so on, coming to me and talking about their experience here in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And then when I spoke to these young Jewish students, I asked them, well, who is actually harassing you? Who is actually doing these terrible things when they're getting beaten up on campus and attacked and so on? And they say, well, these are people who don't know anything about Palestine, because these are white Germans.
Oh.
And I thought that was one revelation to me talking to these young students. They were not blaming the young Palestinians or the Arabs or the others. And they were saying, yes, they suffer. You know, they have their problems too. They suffer just as we suffer. But it's these other people who are coming here who don't understand the issue in the Middle East, who don't understand what is anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, but who are taking these very strong positions against us.
A few small questions at the end, so Moritz can have some time to ask you. I mean, could you talk to everyone you wanted to talk to in Germany? You didn't only visit Berlin, you visited a lot of cities in these 2 weeks. Did everybody respond or were like, Irene, yeah, come on?
Well, a lot of more people would have seen me if I had had time and that many more hours in the day in terms of civil society, activists. I received 140 written submissions even before I arrived here.
Wow.
Just in 10 days or something, people heard I was coming and they took the trouble to write 2, 3, 4 pages about the information they had. I did not always get the officials that I wanted to meet.
Who did you get?
I didn't get the mayor of Berlin.
That's ironic.
Isn't it? Especially given the situation of my colleague, Francesca Albanese.
Yeah, and we talked about repression of Palestinian protests, especially, I think it's especially bad in Berlin. I don't know if that's part of your findings, but like there's a big regional discrepancy.
There is indeed a lot more complaints that we have received about, from people in Berlin about protests and so on. Mm-hmm. And the officials who met with me, I met with the State Secretary of Interior and with the head of police. They were there. They realized they were under scrutiny. They were willing to answer questions. And they even, I think, acknowledged that in the early days, they were not prepared and had got things perhaps wrong. And they were trying to improve things, etc. So they were there, at least. I appreciated the fact that they were there and they were ready to give me as much information as they had. But there were others who were not prepared to actually sit down and have that conversation.
Three more fundamental questions. I mean, there's a leftist view who's represented by, like there should be an unconditional freedom of speech. Irene, what is your take on that? Because, like, from a leftist point of view, it's like the state itself can never be trusted to protect speech, because in the end, the state wants to protect itself.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, freedom of speech will lose against the interests of the state.
Well, freedom of speech is a universal right. Uh-huh. It comes out of our human dignity. As human beings, we need it for our human dignity. So it's not something that is tied to a state. Okay. You obviously need state machinery to make things happen. And you need to have transparent, accountable systems of justice so that those who have the power to act with regard to your freedom of expression, whether it's the police, whether it's the Minister for Information, whatever, are held to account. So you need a state machinery without which it cannot be implemented, but your human right is inherent in you as a human being. It cannot be taken away from you.
And you talk about there should be limits on, you know, expression of opinion online, especially when it comes to destroying reputation.
There has to be, and freedom of expression is not an absolute right.
Of course. Yeah. What about defamation? I mean, this is basically defamation of living persons. Mm-hmm. What about defamation of dead people? I mean, right now, this the big Epstein affair and all this, I mean, people seem to be freely, I mean, they can call Mr. Epstein a pedophile because he's dead. Is that a rightful distinction, you know, defaming living people and dead people?
At a technical level, the estate of Mr. Epstein could act on his behalf, the estate, whoever.
Yes.
Holds his assets after his death.
Yes.
But I think human rights are actually more about living people because they change, they move on. And there are challenges coming to it. For example, with artificial intelligence. Does artificial intelligence have a right to freedom of expression online?
That would be my last question. Yeah.
And that is something I think that we're all struggling to figure out because we don't know where technology will take us. But that's an extremely important ethical as well as legal question.
So there are only human rights when you're alive?
Well, human rights are about human beings.
Yeah. And a human being is only a human being when he or she is alive.
But there are some rights that might continue even after death, you know, because of children or because of various other things. But by and large, we are talking about what is happening here and now in terms of human rights, freedom of expression, and the challenges that we are facing, and the need, I think, for all of us to understand the responsibility that we have with the right to freedom of expression.
And is it my
it's a right, but also a responsibility.
Is it my freedom of expression to generate AI images of women or powerful politicians, female people or something?
No.
Who are nude or like in a pornographic environment?
That's a crime. I mean, it's not your freedom of expression to...
It's art, Irene. Yeah. It's art.
If it is art, yes. So you have to contextualize it. Because, of course, there is art, but art it has to be through consent. Art has to be, you know, to whom are you presenting it? Is it for children or is it for adults? Mm-hmm. And is there a consensual relationship there? Are you exploiting the image, the object of your art? So there are various constraints there. But yes, it can be. And that's why contextualizing speech is so important. What is pornography in one context can be art in another context. So therefore, when you say that something is hate speech, you look at it in another context. For example, from the river to the sea can become something else.
But love speech must be unconditional, right? Can we agree on this? Love speech, opposite of hate speech.
Well,
unconditional.
Unconditional, yes, certainly from your mother.
Anybody. Thanks so much. This was rather short for a Young and Naive show, but like rather long for you. Thanks so much for coming, and please come back anytime.
Thank you very much.
And Moritz is our social media guy, and he makes his debut on Young and Naive. Have fun with him.
Thank you.
Right. Hello, Irene.
Hi.
There's been a very passionate discussion since, I mean, this topic strikes a lot of notes in people, I guess. Something that came up in some variation more than one time is that the monitoring of these issues regarding free speeches might be sort of useless if there is no concrete action being taken to combat it. So, yeah, I'd like to hear your take on that.
Monitoring, well, it depends on what you mean by concrete action. You know, there are many different things that can be done, and platforms in particular, which control the flow of online speech, by monitoring it, what they can do is they can amplify, they can also de-amplify certain types of information, certain types of speech, which they do all the time. They can check whether it is a bot, or whether it's actually authentic voice. So there are various things that can be done, and if not done, can have consequences.
Right. That actually brings me to another question that came up, which is that somebody was wondering what your opinion is on regulations that would require people to be identifiable in their true identity based on usernames online, for example, to combat hate speech or whatever. So do you see bigger risks in that, or are you more pro sort of?
There's a whole discussion around that, especially with respect to children. That if social media access is restricted for children, then of course one would have to prove age, and that has created huge problems in the UK, where it has been introduced, also in Australia and other places. Identity can be a problem because we have to realize that the freedoms that we enjoy, sitting here, like you and I are talking, are not necessarily available to everyone, and exposing your identity can actually threaten your life in some countries. So there are a lot of risks involved there too. And that's why anonymity is really valued on closed platforms, for example. But of course, the state, the government will, many governments are putting pressure on platforms to allow access to be able to identify, because they say there's organized crime taking place, right, and so on. And there's a court case, I think in France now, against the owner of Telegram.
Yeah, right. Duof, I think he was arrested at the airport.
Exactly. And case about all the anonymous activity. And the French police claim that it's criminal activity that's taking place on the platforms. So there is that end, the security crime end, that, of course, governments will want to. But the question is, how far does it go? I think there has to be, again, a balance between people's right to remain anonymous and therefore free to use the platform to communicate. Don't forget that there are many groups, for example, LGBTI groups, in some countries, women's groups, certain political groups, who would be endangered by exposing their identity.
Right. Since Francesca Albanese came up very late in this in the talk, I was just wondering, If UN special rapporteurs aren't, for context, I guess it would be fair to say that she's faced repercussions that would be fair, if one would call them almost personal sanctions, for her job. So Do you think it's a bad sign that even UN special rapporteurs aren't protected from having these rights infringed upon?
I think it's not just a bad sign. It's a very dangerous sign because in her case, she has been empowered by the United Nations, of which the United States is a member, and she was asked to do a job. She is doing the job. If she wasn't doing her job, they could have fired her. But the fact that she maintains her mandate and had it renewed as recently as last year means that the governments are okay with what she's doing. And then to hold her liable in such a way that is destroying her personal life, it's making it impossible because, as I mentioned right at the beginning, I'm not an employee of the United Nations. So I don't have full diplomatic immunity. I only have diplomatic immunity for what I'm saying here. But I have my ordinary life outside that.
Right.
And if you don't have access to your bank account, if you don't have access to your property, but you're forced to pay taxes in the U.S., but your apartment has been sort of blocked by the government, what do you do as an ordinary person? So I think it's an extremely unfair and dangerous thing because who else would then want to go and take on this job?
Okay, one last question because we are running a little bit short on time. There was somebody who asked why a state that would be thriving to become or remain a world power stick to international law, and I guess here that means allowing freedom of speech to flourish and to remain a fundamental right. Isn't that sort of a competitive disadvantage, if you will, out of the state's perspective?
Well, I think if you look at states that are stable, that are strong, that are doing well, they generally tend to be states where the citizens trust the state and the state trusts its own citizens. Otherwise, you will constantly have problems in your own country. You will, as a government, you will be watching your own back. And as a citizen, you will not trust your government. And that's a very dangerous situation. And that's why countries that are free, that are democratic, that respect people's rights, are really countries that are likely to be more sustainable, more stable in the future. Yes, they have their ups and downs, but democracy and human rights are still probably the best forms of governance that we have known.
So you're saying, in the end, what keeps a country a world power is not military might or geopolitical strength,
people.
But the rights of, it, yeah. of its people. Irene, thank you so much for your time, for being here. Keep in mind that this is a viewer-funded show, and if it weren't for our audience's support, we wouldn't be around. So please keep that up via PayPal and via bank transfer. And everybody make sure to tune in next time. Thank you and bye-bye.